Oh, what have you done? We're fine. It's all right. Just move some things around here. In fact, let's do this little dealy. Well, good morning. If I've not had a chance to speak with you yet, my name is Greg, and I am one of the pastors here at Redeemer. This is quite the chapter, and I've already told Rachel, if the sermon happens to go long, and you know, a preacher goes long sometimes, doesn't he? Did we lose something there? Oh, no signal.
There we go.
If the present to external display, there we go. If the pastor destroys the tech as it goes on, then it might go long. Because there's a lot of words in here. It is really like one chunk of thought from Jesus, and that's why we're tackling it all in one go. But there's a lot of stuff going on here. And so we're going to try and get to, we won't get to literally everything. And if you have questions, there's always a place you can go to. You'll see it on the next slide, redeemermcr.com/ask, and you can send in questions. I won't know who it's from, so you can be free to ask any question that you want. But when I read something like this, it makes me think of blockbuster films, of big, like, impressive action novels, things like that. And I think in every big blockbuster film, in every popular novel, you're going to find some kind of variation of what's called the hero's journey. So you got Luke. I can just say Luke, especially with my Star Wars-obsessed kid. There's Luke. There's Dorothy. There's Harry. There's Moana. You just use single names, single words as their name. There's a big mission that each one of these people take. This is the hero's journey, a big, massive mission. They're on their mission. They encounter resistance along the way. They persevere through it, and there's some kind of reward at the end. This is the story. We love this story so much. We can't help but write novels about it. We can't help but make movies about it. We can't help but make songs about it. And it's exciting for us because when we read these things or listen to them or watch these things, we imagine ourselves as the hero. When I'm in the cinema, I see Batman on the screen. There's a part of me, a very deluded part of me, that thinks, I'm kind of like Batman. And that's the excitement of it, right? Like we put ourselves in that position. But we know in the real world, we're not heroes. When the film's done, you're leaving the cinema, I'm waddling back to my car, I know I'm not really Batman. We're far from it. Even when we delude ourselves to construct life to be all about us deep down, we know we're not the heroes that we really like to think that we are. We just can't be. See, we all yearn to be heroes, but really, we know what we're like. We're not heroes. And the older we get, the more we learn about ourselves, the more like this of who we are is actually way further this way. And the more we learn about this world, the kind of heroes that we need, this part's way further this way. So it's a huge, massive gap. What do we do with this gap? How do we deal with that? Christians believe that Jesus is the ultimate hero. He has the ultimate mission of bringing life into what was previously death. He encountered resistance along the way. He was put to death. He died. He persevered even through death. And in the end, he has his reward. And his reward is twofold. He's God. He gets all the glory. Also, part of his reward is seeing us filled with him, being filled with God. That means we don't have to be heroes. We don't have to be Jesus because he is. We don't have to be that person. And we're not, so let's not pretend that we are. Jesus is the only hero that we need. But then there's also this. When Jesus changes our hearts, he not only saves the end of our lives, he saves everything else leading up into it. He doesn't just save the end of our lives, he saves everything else that's leading up to it. He brings us along on his hero journey so we can experience more of God and be more full of him, and so that other people can as well. So as we go, in verse 10, or chapter 10, it's not really... This is our journey. It's not really a hero's journey. And we're going to talk about how it's not really heroic in the least. But Jesus lays it out simply as the Christian journey. And in the Christian journey, we're called to be sent. There is resistance. How we respond to that resistance teaches us about what we really love. And then there's a reward. We're called to a reward as well. So these disciples who we've had praying, we talked about last week. We ended, if you're in chapter 10, just look one verse up or two verses up in chapter 9. The disciples, they're praying for people to go out and to tell people about Jesus, to live out this kingdom thing. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out his workers into his harvest field. And then if you look at the heading in chapter 10, Jesus sends out the 12. So they're praying for more people to be sent, and turns out they themselves are sent. And so what in the world is happening here? This is the story that they are now caught up into. sending out more workers to know about Jesus and his kingdom. And the very first thing we find is that they are called to be sent. And actually, before they're called to be sent, they're called by something. They're called by their names. They're listed here, verses 2 and 3. See, another word for disciple is follower. Jesus calls his followers to him by name. He knows them specifically. Before he does any sending, before he asks us to do anything, before he calls us to himself by our names. He doesn't call not you. He calls you, who you are. He calls us as we are. I think that in itself is a very encouraging thing to reflect upon, especially if you know anything of those names in verses 2 and 3. You know, these are some jacked up guys. They don't have their lives all together. Now, you may not be James, son of Zebedee, but you are somebody, son or daughter of someone. And it's the you that Jesus calls. He doesn't call not you. He calls you as you are to himself. He calls you, and it's good for you to come to him. So he calls you. He calls us by name, but then, like, for what? There's a reason here. He calls us by name to be sent. Jesus calls us, and he has a plan to bring in his light and push back the darkness. And this is something he could do just by himself, but he includes us to be part of it, kind of like bring your kid to work day. In verse 1, it says to drive out impure spirits, to heal every disease and sickness. In verse 8, it says to heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. This is spiritual first and therefore physical. Spiritual things with physical implications. There's something here in the healing that's bigger than the healing itself. The same thing in Jesus' life, the same thing in our life as the disciples. Because our actions become signs, a sign that God's kingdom is here. It's more than just helping somebody, more than being nice, more than being big community. Those things are great. But it's about a sign of a spiritual reality of God's kingdom is here. If you have questions about what the heck does that mean, send them in and we'll talk about them after the sermon. If that's true, if those actions are true or part of that, then with that comes a message. And that message comes up in verse 7. It says, as you go, proclaim this message. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Now, that's a very churchy thing. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Like, you know, people will say that in church, or maybe someone preaching on the street will say that in like a very like aggressive way. That means that all of who God is has come to bear on this earth. All the love that he has, everything, all the good stuff that he has come to bear on this earth. That's an amazing message to proclaim. There's lots of different ways to proclaim that. So we demonstrate what it means for God's way of life to be unleashed in our actions, and then we declare it in using our words to tell other people about it as well. Words and actions, they point to God's kingdom. We live lives in accordance with the gospel, and we talk about it when it makes sense with other people. Now, not many of you that I know have a gift of healing every single physical sickness. I don't know, maybe you guys do and you're holding out on me, and if so, especially come cold time, I'm going to come knocking. But all of us, every single one of us, is that me? I keep on doing that. Trying not to make any bad moves. All of us can sit with somebody, can listen to somebody, can make dinner for somebody, be a good neighbor to somebody. Now, that may not be healing a physical sickness, but that's healing a relational brokenness. And in a world that's awash, I mean, we're in a loneliness epidemic, right? For us to be able to be a part of helping to heal that is part of being a part of having a gift of healing. Now, if we look at, look with me real quick to verse 7, if you got your Bibles open there. And verse 7 says, as you go, proclaim this message. That word proclaim, that's where we get the word preach. That's what's going on right now. I'm proclaiming, hopefully decently enough. But it's also something more than that. I'm a preacher, but I'm in a church full of preachers. Now, your context might be different than this right now, as is mine, six other days of the week. But make no mistake, you're a preacher. You're a proclaimer, not one of those, one of these. In fact, you get to proclaim God's goodness when you talk to other people. You get to bring his light to bear in someone else's ocean of darkness. That is what you get to do. This might only be a sentence every now and then, and that's okay. But know what you do as a follower of Jesus is to bring his light to bear, even if it's only one sentence every now and then. So, how can we do this? Because all of this, and we only just got started, all this sounds really intense. Jesus is like very intense in this chapter. What is the deal here? It gets more intense, so something to look forward to, because it seems like Jesus is sending these people out like under-resourced. He's sending people out who are sheep among wolves. You don't send sheep on a journey where wolves are going to be there. You just don't do that. And then In verses 9 and 10, it's like, don't overpack, don't bring loads of money, don't even bring an extra shirt, and don't even bring, it'd be much easier to bring a staff with you. Don't even bring that. Verse 16 tells us we should be wise in how we go about this mission, but then we're sheep and there are wolves out there. What can we really do? You don't send a sheep out there. And if you could take an extra shirt, like, why not, Jesus? If you could take a little extra money, like, why not? Is this really going about God's mission in a wise way? Now, all of that would seem to be a problem. And you'd be right, except for one thing. That all of this, every single thing, is in the power and authority of Jesus, not us. If it's in our power and our authority, yeah, this would be a huge, massive roadblock. But it's not. It's in Jesus' power and his authority. So we can have a think about what we think we need or not. We can have a healthy retirement plan or not. Of course, it's good to have a healthy retirement plan, but we don't have to have one in order to survive. Don't mistake our wisdom with Jesus' power and his authority working through you. Now, let me first talk about what this is not saying. This is not saying don't be wise with not planning, don't be unwise with planning. It's not saying like spend your money however you want to. We're called to use our brains and the Spirit's wisdom to make good choices. What this is saying is that you must proceed in faith, relying on Jesus in all things. I mean, how many times in your life, as in mine, have you used money as a placeholder for faith? Every single one of us have. If I only had this much, then I'd be okay. That's all of us. Case in point, maybe, of what Jesus is saying is the existence of Redeemer. We were sent out under-resourced to be sheep among wolves, and yet God has always been at work, right? On paper, Redeemer should never have existed, and yet God has always been at work. If we depended on ourselves, if we depended first on fundraising, if we depended on one person's job to lead stuff, we would not use our need as an opportunity to grow in our faith. And that is the point that Jesus is bringing up, to use your need as an opportunity to grow in faith. Now, as Mike shared at the Family Vision meeting a few weeks ago, as a church, we are financially behind where we need to be. This doesn't mean we're going to plow on as if that's not true and just call it faith. Like, that would be unwise. We're going to be wise with how we make financial decisions, and likely that means things will have to get cut back. An example would be, for example, like our church office. It's great to have a church office. It's really helpful in organizing stuff, really helpful for the mission. But if we don't have the money to pay for it, then that's something we're going to have to give up, and that's okay. Because God's in charge. We don't need to have a church office to survive as a church. We haven't up until 6 months ago or 9 months ago, and we've been okay. Or maybe it could be the other side. Maybe through prayer, we can continue on God's mission in this way, and God's going to provide a way for us to have something like an office or whatever it might be through people giving. We don't make the decisions of whether Redeemer is going to grow or not depending on if we have enough money, if we have an office, if we have this or that. The engine of this is Jesus' power and his authority. We trust God first, and then we're wise with the other, with the details. Now, if you don't already know this, when you act and speak in the way that Jesus is talking about, not everybody is going to be stoked. Not everybody's going to be so excited. Oh, wait, what? Tell me again? What am I doing here? I need to figure this out. I'm sorry. This is freaking me out. What is the, is it me? It must be me. I keep on moving. Of course, now it's not going to do it. Oh, maybe I shouldn't trust in tech. Maybe this is like an application in process. We know that when we speak this way, people are going to be like, oh, that is the best thing I've ever heard in my life. Can you please tell me more about Jesus? Can we read the Bible together? Can we do an inductive Bible study? Do you have a small group I can meet at? Do you have like church meetings? How many church meetings can I fit on a Sunday? You know, it's just not going to happen, right? We know this. We all know this, which is why we're afraid to follow Jesus with this part of our life that he tells us to follow him with. There is pushback. There's more than that. There's resistance. We should expect it and plan on it. And we'll get there in a moment. But before we do, there's something I don't want us to miss out, because if we miss out on this, we'll miss out on everything. There's a key here at the end of verse 8 that's really important for us to get. So if, with your Bibles here, go to verse 8, the last sentence there, freely you have received, freely give. When we feel the lack that we have, and we do often, especially when it comes to being on his mission, if we don't feel like we have enough passion or courage or money or wisdom or expertise, whatever the thing might be, one thing is true. We never lack God's love. We never lack Jesus' presence. We never lack his power. Never, ever. And if you're not a Christian, this is an amazing thing to get in on. In fact, we have an overflow of all those things and more in our lives as Christians. So if it's an overflow that's already spilling out anyway, we could maybe give some of that to somebody else. We can't keep it all ourselves. And it's in that overflow we're called to work out of. Not a deficit, but an overflow. Freely you have received, freely given. You can't give what hasn't been given to you. It's when we realize just how much we've been given, this is what frees us from our missionary anxiety that we all have. We're freed from, I have to do something, but I don't think I can, I'm not good enough, and I'm a bad Christian, and can't we just like talk about something else like a Bible study? Yeah, that's how all of us feel. We're all there. Until you understand how much you've received from Jesus, you won't be able to do any of this stuff that he's talking about. See, the first step in living as a missionary, which if you're a Christian, that's what you are, the very first step is not doing something, but to realize all the things that have already been done for you first. Working out of our missionary identity as Christians requires us to first understand how loved we are by God, how we are his children, how he has drawn us as we are by our names to himself first. And if you don't get that, then none of this that we're going to talk about today really matters. You can't give what hasn't been given to you. So let's talk about what Jesus spends the bulk of this chapter on, and that is resistance. Resistance. There's three times as many verses in here about the resistance we're going to get versus like the actual things we're supposed to do. We don't actually get loads of information on what we're actually supposed to do. We get a lot on how people are going to respond to us negatively. So let's talk about this. This is in verses 16 through 33 to begin with. And I really hope that this honest discussion from Jesus leads us to be honest with the resistance that we all experience. Every single one of us does. Last week, we talked about our internal weakness in chapter 9. That's what chapter 9 was about. The focus on this chapter in chapter 10 is about external resistance. It's not internal resistance as much as it's external. Now, we live in a culture that is, by and large, hostile to the gospel. And this gospel-hostile culture, though not nearly as bad for us as it was for the disciples then and for most Christians around the world today, is still very difficult for us. We don't need to add on to difficulty, right? It has the potential to knock us from following Jesus, to keep us off his mission. Verse 21 says, people will betray you. Verse 22 says, you'll be hated. And with me and Christina have experienced both these things, I'm sure many of you have as well. People who were formerly close to you, even family members, are going to betray you because you follow Jesus in the way that he tells you to. People are going to hate you because you follow Jesus the way that he tells us. There's even the possibility of death. Now, when we go through these verses here, I mean, Jesus is not anything if not honest, right? He's letting everybody know what's going on first. When we go through this, I don't know about you, but I am tempted to just kind of give up. Like, I don't really want to do this part. I'll do maybe some other parts. Like, I can do this, but this, I don't know if I can do that. What's it all for? If this is what I get for trying to help people, then why even try? I talk about Jesus all the time and haven't seen people come to faith, or I'm tired and I want to give up. We all say those things. We all feel those things. Jesus knows this is how we're going to be tempted to respond. He knows this is going to knock us. But resistance is evidence of something. The resistance we experience is evidence of the hold of the power of darkness on our world, the grip it has on those people who we really love. See, we are sent to push back these very powers, to bring in his light. Of course there's going to be resistance. The Bible in other places uses metaphors of like battle imagery and war imagery. Of course there's going to be resistance. It is a war. You'll get death threats. You'll get horrible texts and emails. There'll be gossip. There'll be betrayals. And those are the things you do know about, let alone all the things you don't know about. If there wasn't a real threat, if the resistance wasn't that big of a deal, our job would be really easy. But the reason it's so difficult is because we are at war with the second most powerful thing in this world, the power of death. And it's going to do all it can to fight back against us. For most of us, not all, but for most, we really aren't fearing death. I don't fear death, but I do fear awkwardness. I do fear relational death. And awkwardness, maybe that's even worse than death. At least with death, you're done. You don't have to deal with it. But we definitely fear the broken relationships thing. And I get it. I'm completely there with you. Now, we think we have it bad, but really, if you think about it, we don't really have a range of resistance in our lives, because in most of our experiences, we're not fearing death. We're not being chucked out of our families. We're not like under penalty. We don't have to meet underground. It's actually not as bad as it could be, but it's enough.
Right.
We don't need any more. It's enough. It's difficult enough. So we can maybe toughen up a little bit, and there's that. But Jesus tells us a few other things. He says first, in verse 23, he says, basically, don't go searching after persecution. If someone's beating you, like, leave. Like, don't get beaten. Don't hang around. Go. Jesus is working in all places, and so why stay in this place? That's really difficult if you could just go here, where you don't get beaten for talking about Jesus. Stay on the mission. No need to get more bruises than what you're already going to receive anyway. You know, just a bit of a side note on that. Maybe this a way this could be applied is to just don't go pick fights. Some Christians, and this is not really a Redeemer thing, but this is like a general Christian thing maybe. Some Christians love to pick fights or arguments about things that just kind of don't matter. Just please don't be dumb and pick fights that you don't really need to. There's enough resistance out there. And maybe just one other thing about persecution. I think sometimes in the Christian world, we Christians can think we're being persecuted when really we're not. If we're kind of dumb or mean in the way that we talk about something and someone doesn't like us for that, that's not because we're being persecuted. It just means you're kind of a jerk. So like that's who we are too, because we're not perfect either. Don't use the word persecution when something like that happens. There's more than enough real resistance out there. We don't need to manufacture more. So don't be a jerk and don't ask for more beatings. Maybe that's like the Jesus paragraph or paraphrase version. So what else is he saying here? Well, secondly, Jesus uses this as an opportunity to bring up an identity issue. If Jesus is the king, then we're his servants. Verses 24 through 26 talk about this. And because he knows we need to get it, he repeats himself in verses 28 through 31. What should we expect? Servants get treated like kings? No. Queens? No. They get treated like servants. Servants aren't treated the best in the world. I don't know if you know this or not. If others put the king to death, how are they going to react to us? We should expect to be treated like servants because this is who we are, and that requires humility. Lastly, in line with us being servants and him being the king, what Jesus wants us to do is kind of realign our fears. If Jesus is the king and we are servants, why are we more afraid of this like rabble over here? Why does that control our lives? Fear of other people who are going to possibly say stuff about us. We don't even know if they are. We don't even want to give them the chance, so we don't. When we give in to fear, we're letting other people lead us, not Jesus. Then we're not following Jesus. We're following our fears. We're letting them lead us. And that's what Jesus is getting at in verse 28, which has a gravity to it. Do not be afraid of those who can kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Jesus is not saying this to make someone respond out of, I'm so afraid I'm going to be crushed if I don't do this. He's saying, who's really in charge here? Who really has power here? Who really has authority here? That's the one you should follow. Who's really in control? Not this person, not that person. God is. And without you being on his mission, what hope are they even going to have anyway? So let's be led by Jesus, not by our fears. Now, all of this, again, is enough to be like, why do this anyway? If you're new to the faith or even contemplating the faith, you're like, if this is what, I don't want to sign up for this. This sounds insane. It is insane, believe me. But what happens when Jesus sends us out on his mission is that the mission itself, that resistance, exposes what we love. It really shows us who we really are and what we really love. The context for our discipleship, our growth in the faith, is mission. That means if we aren't following Jesus in this way, we aren't growing in how we follow Jesus. So the context for discipleship is mission. That means resistance that we experience is actually not the problem and ought not to be our focus. It's about how we respond to the resistance. So what does Jesus teach us about this? Well, if we look at verses 32 through 39, this is where he's talking about how you respond to resistance exposes what we really love. How we act in the face of resistance exposes who we really are. When you squeeze a toothpaste tube, what comes out? What was in there before? Hopefully toothpaste. If not, I don't know where you bought your stuff from. There's a guy from the back of his van the other day. Man against father, daughter against mother. What's going on with that? Jesus isn't saying, now you get to live your best emo teen life and hate your parents and get into fights with them all the time. He's not saying that. He's telling us that what he requires is a radical reorganization of our loves. We all have many loves. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. But whatever is at the top affects all our others. Jesus is saying, I'm the king. I'm at the top, and it's the best for me to be up there because it helps all the other people who you care about in your life. And this is not only good for you, it's good for other people. See, the mission whittles things away. It chisels us. It turns us into who God really wants us to be. before the mission is for anyone else, it's for us. That's not something we think of very often. Often we think of, oh, being on Jesus' mission is a thing for other people. No. That's not what Jesus is saying. It's for us first. God's mission is for us first. When Jesus first changes us, our lives get reorganized. Now we serve him. We don't serve other things. And proof of our lives being reorganized with Jesus at the top, proof of that is we take up our cross. We lose our life. We see ourselves as servants, not kings. In verses 38 through 39, again, another hard saying in this chapter, whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds their life will lose it. Whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. Now, that might mean we're in awkward situations, as much as I might try and avoid that. It might mean we venture and say something about God's love that we wouldn't have otherwise. And as we do this, we develop resiliency, we develop a resilient faith. And the resistance has nothing on those with resilient faith in Jesus. Nothing. Also, as we do this, there's a built-in benefit. Because we lose our life, that thing that was already dead to begin with, and we get his as we go through it. As we take up our cross on behalf of other people, we have a greater appreciation and love for Jesus who took up his cross on behalf of us. We find life. You know that very thing that every single human since the beginning of time has been trying to search for, has written songs about, the reason why we have families, the reason why we get partners and careers, all the expectations that we have, that thing called life, we get it. We get it from him. He gives it, and only he can give it because he's the only one who has it. That's what we find more of that while we follow him in the way that he calls us to. There is a resistance, but it's how we respond to it that we uncover more of his life, more of his love. We miss out when we don't. And not to mention other people. We haven't even talked about other people yet. And to underline this point, Jesus talks a little bit more about the benefits that we get through following him. So we aren't just called by name. We aren't just called to be sent. We're also called for something else. We're called to a reward. What we do in our temporal earthly lives, our normal day-to-day kind of humdrum kind of lives, is connected to eternal heavenly realities. In verses 40 through 42, we are sent so that people will welcome our message of God's kingdom. Welcoming us leads to new people welcoming him. You know, I've been trying really hard not to use quotes from Gladiator, that epic film in 2000 starring Russell Crowe. I've been trying really hard in my pastoral life. 2023, that's 23 years. I'm pretty sure I've never used a quote from Gladiator. But the problem is, it's just so quotable, especially here. I had to give in, but after 23 years, how could I not? What main character says, Russell Crowe's character says, what we do in life echoes in eternity. That's exactly what Jesus is saying here. What we do in our day-to-day, it echoes out in eternal realities. What we do here on earth reverberates against across heavenly realms in our time and in his time. And when others come into his family, it's a celebration. It's a party. These are the people that we love. These are the people we've been praying for. These are the people that we've been inviting and welcoming into our homes, missional communities, Sundays, out for coffee, out for drinks, whatever. And they get the life they've been searching for. We get to be a part of that. On this journey, there is a reward for others. And maybe that's you if you're investigating what Christianity is all about. There's also a reward for us, for those who are Christians. A righteous reward, which immediately makes me think of another epic film, that 1989 classic, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. It is most righteous. That is an old reference now. Maybe it's cool again, probably not. But as we follow him, we depend more on him, and we get more of him. We know more of him. We love more of him with more of ourselves. The reward is life. Eternal life does not start when we die. It's now. We don't need to wait for it. It's now. It's here because God's kingdom is here. That message we proclaim, we believe God's kingdom is here, and it never, ever ends. This is better than mere life beyond death. This is love beyond death. That makes all of this worth it, worth giving everything up for. Love now, never stopping, continual, never-ending crescendo of God himself. And this reward is for the sent ones. If you follow Jesus, that's your name. That's what you are. He's the sent one. He talks about himself like that often. And we are sent ones. Another word for sent one that sounds a little less awkward is missionary. Just as we are servants, we are missionaries. When Jesus changes us, we became his representative in a land that doesn't yet pledge allegiance to him. So we are ambassadors. Now, an ambassador does not have authority in herself. She has authority from the country that she represents. And we represent God's kingdom. We represent God himself. So ultimately, the reward is for the sent ones, is the sent one, Jesus himself. And the way that Jesus is talking here, we see that our mission, as much as we talk about that, as much as we are involving our lives with it, mission is actually not the goal. God's mission is not the goal. It's the way, it's the journey, it's a means. It's not the end. Mission is not the destination. One day, mission won't exist anymore. Mission is temporary. The mission does not give life. Jesus is the goal. He is not temporary. He's eternal. It's his way. He's the destination. Mission's temporary. One day we won't need it anymore. He's eternal. We're called by name, sent to speak Jesus' words and welcome others into his family. There's resistance along this mission, but someone far greater is on this mission with us. Jesus, God himself. Those who follow get life and love forever and ever. Now, there are some really difficult truths in here. And we only spent, was it like 30 minutes, maybe a little bit more than that, just looking at some of those things. How in the world can we do this? Is this like one of those sermons where you're like, yeah, and then Sunday evening you're like, ugh, and then Monday you're like, nope. You know, I've been through those sermons before. It's not like, let's all do this thing. Okay, yeah, let's all do this thing. Like, wait, hang on. I don't think I can. No, I'm fine. I just need to go to work. For Christians, this is a high bar, right? When I read something like this, I think I'm a bad Christian. Is there hope for bad Christians? A hero's journey is for heroes, and I'm not that. I'm not a hero. Here's a secret. Every single one of us, we're all bad Christians. We're the worst. And of course there's hope for bad Christians. There's only been one good Christian where we get the word Christian from. And that Christ carried his cross. He doesn't want us to carry his cross. He already did it. He said it's finished. We don't have to carry his. We don't have to be him. Now, it's not mentioned in this chapter, but the way we can do this is because Jesus is with us. The way that he's with us is through his Holy Spirit. After his resurrection, he breathed his spirit on those who followed him, and he continues to do so on those who follow him. That's the Holy Spirit. We have Jesus with us, along with us, every single step as we encounter every part of the resistance that he knows we're going to get in touch with. The only one to successfully complete the hero journey is Jesus. He's really the only hero, the only one who could save us from the resistance of death and bring his love and goodness to us. And what we do is respond to him. He brings us along with him, and he continues to bring his kingdom to bear upon a dark and needy world. And we could never be the hero, but it's really good that we don't have to be. We don't need to be. He is. His journey cost him his life on the cross. That's some resistance. And more than his own life, he took all of our resistance, all the powers of darkness. They were all set upon him. Jesus' cross bore infinite resistance. Now, he went through that then, because he wants us to find life here and now. He doesn't want us to waste our lives searching for life in places that are just never going to have it, going on some less meaningful journey that we've figured out ourselves. He has life, and it's on his journey that we discover more of it. And through his death, the sinful resistance that we have towards his life originally, that ongoing resistance we have towards his mission, all that power is put to death through him. He is our king now. We will be tempted to give up. Of course, everybody will. But his power in you is greater than that. Jesus took up his cross and rose again so we would rise again. And in our resurrection life, through his Holy Spirit, he doesn't call us to take up his cross. That's impossible. He's already done it anyway. What he does call us, though, is for us to take up ours. That's a requirement for following him. Our cross is not impossible. It's not too much. It might be difficult at times, for sure. But it's not beyond what we can bear. And the reason that's true is because he's there with us, always giving us what we need through his Holy Spirit. He took up his cross so we can take up our little crosses. And if you're a Christian, I wonder what that might mean for you now, this week, or even maybe today, what it might mean to take up your cross. And that's gonna be different answers for every single one of us. As much as we understand his cross, as much as we cherish this for ourselves, we're going to want other people to have it. Now, if you don't have it, I would love for you to know real life. So we're called by name to be sent on his costly mission. This mission exposes what we love. Really, it's not always a great mirror, and gives us an opportunity, though, to love Jesus more. And as we do this, others get life, and we get to treasure it all the more. Now, the ultimate symbol Jesus gave us of this is the Lord's Supper, a symbol of cost and reward at the same time. It's found in the Lord's Supper. We reflect on both. We look back to Jesus' death and resurrection, and we look to the day when he will make all things new. Now, celebrating the Lord's Supper is an act of worship for a Christian. It's kind of declaring God, you are the king, and I follow you, and I'm your servant. So if you don't believe that, please don't take it. No one's trying to force anything down anyone's throat here. It ought to be something that's true from within you first before you do something outward. And as we eat, we'll think of the bread as a symbol of Jesus' body. His whole body died. His whole body did. Not just small parts of him, his whole body died.